a moody fellow painter linked with the Spanish liberation movement. They arrived by way of the Gare d'Orsay and made their way along the bank of the river, heading for Montmartre. In Barcelona, they had been fitted out for the occasion by a local tailor in arty black corduroy suits with loose jackets and high collars designed to hide the absence of a waistcoat. The wherewithal for Picasso's trip had been provided by his parents. The local newspaper, notified most likely by Picasso himself, had announced the departure for the French capital of two of Barcelona's most promising young artists. They made their way to the Butte de Montmartre and climbed up the hillside as far as the Rue Gabriel, where their friend Isidre Nounel kept a studio. They found themselves in a hilltop village with squat, crumbling houses, vineyards, and squares bordered with chestnut trees. On low green benches, old bohemians sat, watching the world go by, while sparrows pecked in the dirt. The artists who gathered in the cafes were mainly Catalans, poets, and aspiring amateurs. By the time he made his first visit to the French capital, Picasso was already an accomplished draftsman. As a young child in Malaga, he had been taught to draw by his father, José Picasso, an art teacher and curator of the Municipal Museum. He had also attended the Royal Academy of Fine Arts in Madrid, where his education was traditional and rigorous. By the time he graduated, Picasso already possessed a strong and varied artistic vocabulary. In Barcelona, the lives of the city's artists revolved around El Quatre Gats, a large tavern decorated with ornamental tiles in the traditional Spanish style. The Four Cats was a Catalan expression meaning the only four cats in town. Here, everyone gathered to display new work and to debate the issues of the various strands of Catalan modernisme, which was broadly symbolist, depictions of loss, yearning, and erotic desire inscribed within religious and mythological iconography. They craved bohemianism, art for art's sake, decadence, the libertine life of the moderns. They read the symbolist poets, Vélin, Mallarmé, and Baudelaire, all of whose work Picasso was familiar with. Their idea of Paris was bars and café concerts, nightlife, and wild women. Paris was the artistic mecca of the world. On their first evening in Paris, Picasso and Casugemas wrote home. They were disappointed by the nightlife. Picasso's friend reassured his parents. The famed boîte at the foot of the hillside seemed nothing but fanfare and tinsel, papier-mâché stuffed with sawdust. It was all too showy and expensive for them. So far, their dream of Paris seemed to have little to do with reality. As for the Folies Bergères and the Moulin Rouge, if they entered those dens of vice where the crowd exploded while female performers high-kicked and did the splits, such places went unmentioned in letters home. The vibrant, glittering spectacle enjoyed by visitors to the 1900 World Fair hid the reality. In the back streets beyond the area designated for the fair, the crumbling buildings were still medieval, dark and unsanitary. In cramped workshops, seamstresses and laundresses who lived in Montmartre worked 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. The greatest poverty in Montmartre was on the northern flank of the hillside, stretching from the Allée de Brouillard to the Rue Caulaincourt below the Sacré-Cœur. The area of waste ground, called the Maquis, had become an illegal shantytown where the abject poor wandered in the scrubland in broken-down shoes among the chickens they reared for food. By the end of their first day in Paris, Picasso and Casugemas had already hired a model and begun painting in Nounel's studio. The next day, they met their Catalan friends in a café where Picasso began to sketch the locals. Despite his reluctance, Picasso soon found his way to the foot of the Butte. If the nightlife here had seemed tawdry and expensive, it nevertheless exerted its allure. In any case, it was not really necessary to enter the Boite, since the atmosphere of the cabarets spilled out onto the streets. Wine was tax-free throughout Montmartre, another reason why the bohemian lifestyle of the district had set the tone of the French capital. There was more Montmartre in Paris, people said, than Paris in Montmartre. At the foot of the Butte, along the boulevard Rochechouart, the whores with painted faces strolled through the streets, their hair dyed blue-black, as though the streets of Montmartre were another theatrical stage. In the bars, they sat waiting over a drink or leaning on their elbows, head and hands blatantly unchaperoned. Picasso celebrated them in paintings, smouldering with sensuality. The women of Montmartre fascinated him. This 19-year-old boy from Spain, where women were devout in their lace mantillas and the whores plied their trade behind firmly closed doors. His paintings of autumn 1900 seemed to give off the sense of musk and patchouli oil, the chatter of the crowd, the hum of accordion music, all the sensual heat of the streets. The works he painted that autumn are moody, visceral descriptions of the low life of Montmartre. Paintings such as La Tente and The Absinthe Drinker, in which the human form becomes vivid, colourful, subtly exaggerated. This was oil painting as it had never been seen before. One of the Catalans in Picasso's circle was 30-year-old Pere Manache, son of a Barcelona safe and lock manufacturer, a fashionable anarchist, a natural networker with considerable artistic judgment. He had set himself up, albeit modestly, as a dealer in modern Spanish art, principally by getting to know Bert Weil, an American born in Paris, dealer of rare books and antiques, who had just opened her first gallery at 25 Rue Victor Mas, where she had already exhibited work by some of the young Spanish artists around Montmartre. She now agreed to take on a few works by Picasso, including one of the popular windmill-turned-dance hall Au Moulin de la Galette, which she sold immediately. Soon afterwards, Pere Manache arrived in Nounel's studio, bringing with him the Spanish consul, who also bought a painting by Picasso, The Blue Dancer. Picasso worked intensively for the best part of the next 2 months, producing pictures for Manache to show to the dealer Ambroise Vollard. Vollard was different from the other dealers. He had a shrewd eye for a painting and a passion for collecting. Most of the marchands de tableaux in Montmartre were hardly more than peddlers of bric-a-brac. Soulier kept a bric-a-brac shop in the Rue de Martyr, where he sold old beds until he took to buying pictures. He simply bought whatever was cheap. In those days, Rousseau, Van Dongen, young Maurice Utrillo, and occasionally now, Picasso. Pictures became such a passion for Soulier that he gave up the bric-a-brac trade as a rising tide of canvases rose from the ground floor up to his bedroom, forcing him to sleep in a hotel. Père Angelet, known on the Butte as Léon, bald, fat, a retired solicitor's clerk who was losing his sight, collected indiscriminately, until he had to sell the lot for as little as he had paid for it. He was rumoured to be the first ever purchaser of a Picasso, who afterwards uncharitably remarked that the only person who had seen the value of his work in those days had been blind. At Vollard's gallery in June 1901, Picasso exhibited some 64 paintings and drawings. The works were shown more or less pell-mell, hung haphazardly right up to the ceiling, many of them unframed. Some were not even hung, presented instead in large folders for viewers to rifle through. The show included works such as Overdressed Women and French Can-Can, in which a flurry of white, the dancers' petticoats, dominates the foreground, accented with mere flashes of red garter and black stocking. If this was, as some called it, his Toulouse-Lautrec period, the Spanish artist's work introduced a psychological dimension entirely his own. He was looking at the people of Montmartre with the fresh eye and empathy of an outsider. By the standards of the time, the show was a success. More than half the works were sold. Picasso soon got through the money, and he evidently enjoyed the annual Bastille Day celebrations. His painting, 14th of July, 1901, captures the feverish excitement of the crowds on the Boulevard de Clichy. Picasso's band still consisted of his old Catalan friends and their acquaintances, together with the odd bohemian of Montmartre, including Max Jacob, one of the area's more waspish characters, theatrically turned out in frock coat and top hat, who painted after his own fashion, mixing cigarette ash with his colours, wrote decadent, esoteric poetry that harked back to symbolism, and studied the occult and red palms. He had admired Picasso's show at Volard's and had introduced himself. He became one of the artist's true friends in Paris, helping him to learn French. In the evenings, they all went to the Zout, a hovel of a place at 28 Rue Ravignon, a far cry from the café concerts at the foot of the hillside. The Zout was a filthy dive run by Frédé. Picasso and his friends met there most evenings, talking into the small hours, until long after the tables in the cafes had emptied, and only the hardened alcoholics were left slumped for the night against the walls. At dawn, they made their way home, the Moulin de la Galette coming into view like a pale ghost against the sky.
Stella Gonet was reading from In Montmartre by Sue Rowe. It's abridged for radio by Catherine Williams and produced by Duncan Minchell. Tomorrow at the same time, Picasso meets his muse and lover. If you're waiting for Woman's Hour, then make yourself comfortable. They're an hour late this morning, but there's a good reason for that, as we're about to hear. This is BBC Radio.